Thanks. Good morning. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining the call. On behalf of our cooperative studies program, George Ioannou and I will be sharing some work that our group has done on the topic of respiratory virus severity and vaccine effectiveness. We do not have any conflicts of interest to disclose. So by the end of the hour, we hope that you will, first of all, come away with a better understanding of how target trial emulation principles are applied to observational data to make causal inference about respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, and COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness. We'll also highlight the strengths and limitations of the Veterans Health Administration, or VHA, electronic health record data in supporting observational studies. And we will describe evidence from these studies regarding the effectiveness of a couple of different types of vaccine products, as well as the relative severity of COVID-19, flu, and RSV. So we'll start by sharing with you some of the VE studies, move into talking about severity of the respiratory viruses, and then close out with where we go from here. So to start, RSV vaccine effectiveness. So why study this in the VA? As many of you will recall, in the spring of 23, two new RSV vaccine products were approved by the FDA at the time for adults who were 60 years of age and older. There was one that was manufactured by GSK, that's Arexvy, and the other manufactured by Pfizer, that's the Abrysvo product. Now, a couple of the limitations of the clinical trials that were done by these manufacturers were that, one, very few participants at the extremes of age were enrolled in the studies. They also had quite a low prevalence of individuals with cardiopulmonary disease, and most immunocompromised persons were excluded from enrollment. And we know that these are key groups that are at risk for more severe RSV disease. At the same time, we were noticing that vaccine uptake among veterans in our patient population during that first season was quite low. And so we wanted to understand how these vaccines were performing and potentially provide motivation for improving uptake should they be performing well as they did in the clinical trials. So we sought to evaluate the effectiveness of a single RSV vaccine dose to prevent not only documented RSV infections, as well as RSV-associated hospitalization, emergency department encounters, and urgent care encounters during that first respiratory illness season. We used national VHA electronic health record data to emulate a target randomized controlled trial of either of the vaccine products compared with no RSV vaccination for the prevention of documented RSV infection and associated healthcare utilization among veterans 60 years of age and older. We chose as an enrollment that initial four-month period, which coincided with the period during which vaccines became widely available in our healthcare system, and then extended follow-up through the end of March, or essentially the end of that respiratory illness season. And we executed four monthly nested sequential trials during the enrollment period. So first, a couple of words on target trial emulation. It's important to note that these trials may not be, randomized control trials may not be feasible, ethical, or timely in order to answer the causal question of interest. And so we, in order to effectively use real-world data for causal inference, the study really needs to be carefully designed to emulate a hypothetical randomized trial. So we apply design principles from these trials to explicitly tie the analysis of observational data to the trial being emulated. And you can see some of the key features here that we'll highlight as we go through. And in doing so, this helps researchers avoid unnecessary bias and articulate trade-offs. So this is a nested sequential trial study design with matching that our group has heavily relied on for our VE studies. This example illustrates RSV, where we matched each eligible person vaccinated during a given month, so say September, to up to four persons who remained unvaccinated as of that same day, using exact matching followed by propensity score matching to emulate baseline covariate balance achieved through randomization. So what you'll see here is, say, for example, you find someone vaccinated on September 15th. We then try to find the best matches who were unvaccinated as of September 15th. And those pairs or groups are followed through the end of March. You're still left with quite a number of unmatched, unvaccinated folks from that month. And if they remain unvaccinated through September, they then go into the October pool to be considered for matching during that month, and then so on and so forth into November and December. We used VA's corporate data warehouse, which, as many of you are familiar, integrates real-time electronic health record data across all of our facilities nationally and includes information on key demographic, geographic, and clinical variables. I will note that for this particular study, we did not incorporate data from CMS Medicare due to a need for timely analysis. There can be a little bit of a lag in the Medicare data, but I will highlight in later studies where we were able to do so to improve ascertainment of key exposure and outcome variables. RSV tests did have to be performed within our healthcare system, but vaccinations could be administered either on or off station as long as they were recorded in our electronic health record. And I'll highlight here for folks who aren't aware that VA now participates in the Immunization Gateway Program, which facilitates data exchange with state and jurisdictional immunization information systems, and these data are captured in CDW. And so this has really been a nice feature to enhance capture of vaccines for such studies. We included enrollees who were 60 years of age and older during that four-month enrollment period, and also specified that they had to be engaged in VHA care, as you can see here. And that was really to try and make sure that we captured a patient population that was likely to be have a documented RSV vaccine in our system should they be vaccinated and experience outcomes of interest that were also captured through our data systems. And then you can see some of the exclusions here, as you might expect. Typically, like being vaccinated prior to the first day of each trial month, or having experienced a recent RSV illness. Now, I like to show this schematic because it really gives you a picture of what's going on under the hood and really illustrates the complexity. So within each trial month, again, take September as an example, we first exact matched each eligible person who received RSV vaccination to all eligible persons who were unvaccinated as of their assigned index date, using five factors that were associated with vaccination as well as documented RSV infection. So really key critical potential confounders. Then within each exact matching stratum, we performed an additional propensity score matching step. And these are the five exact matching covariates that we used, which included age, immunocompromised status, CAN score, VISN, and a measure of healthcare utilization in the previous year. Immunocompromised status was a defined compositely, which included receipt of immunosuppressive or cancer medications, advanced HIV, which we defined as having a CD4 below 200, or having a hematologic malignancy. And then you can see the propensity score matching covariates, which included a number of demographic, geographic, and clinical factors that we selected a priori. And I'll note that we also included a number of underlying conditions such as BMI, cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, chronic lung disease, diabetes, etc. And as mentioned, we matched up to four unvaccinated persons, and we tried to find the best matches essentially to each vaccinated person. Importantly, anyone who was an unvaccinated comparator who later died, got vaccinated, or tested positive for RSV prior to their assigned index date ended up being dropped from the analysis. And then we reweighted the remaining matched persons equally such that that total weight of the matched persons remained one. We also handled vaccinated persons similarly who tested positive for RSV prior to their index date. In terms of outcomes, our primary outcome was essentially a documented infection beginning day 14 following the index date through the end of the study period. And we did that to mirror both what was done in the clinical trials and also because it was felt that it takes 14 days to develop meaningful immunity following vaccination. And then our secondary outcomes included the ED visits, the urgent care encounters, the hospitalizations, intensive care unit admissions, all occurring within one day of that positive test or death within 30 days. In terms of the statistical analysis, we measured covariate balance after matching using standardized mean differences. Cumulative incidence was estimated using the Allen-Johansen estimator, with death accounted for as a competing risk to estimate the total effect of RSV vaccination. I will say that in secondary analysis, persons were censored at the time of death to also measure the direct effect of vaccination. VE was defined, as you can see here, and derived from the risk ratio, where the risk ratio was calculated by dividing estimates of cumulative incidences between vaccinated and unvaccinated groups at the end of follow-up. And then primary analysis was limited to matched groups in which individuals did not have that positive RSV test during the first 13 days following the index date. And I will say that this was exceedingly rare, and we'll show you that later. And then follow-up started on the day of day 14 and ended either on the day of the outcome of interest, death, or the end of the study period. In terms of the causal contrasts, we did estimate both the a primary intention to treat as well as a secondary per protocol effect. So in other words, for primary, anyone who was assigned as an unvaccinated person but who actually later got vaccinated after the index date was not censored, and they remain analyzed in the unvaccinated arm. Whereas for the per protocol analysis, someone who was assigned unvaccinated but then got vaccinated was censored. And we did use inverse probability censoring weights to reduce potential bias in estimates from censoring. We also chose as our negative outcome control incidence of confirmed diagnoses in that first 13-day window. And this was done to assess for residual confounding or ascertainment bias. And that first 13-day window was felt to correspond to the period when no difference in risk was expected between vaccinated and unvaccinated groups. So in terms of our results, we started with nearly 5 million enrollees who were 60 years of age and older and alive at the start of each of those trial months. And then we ended up with almost 150,000 eligible vaccinated individuals and more than 3 million eligible unvaccinated individuals. We were able to match nearly all of the eligible vaccinated folks, and after matching, baseline characteristics were well balanced between groups. The baseline characteristics are, as you might imagine, in our patient population, predominantly male, non-Hispanic, white, and quite a high prevalence of a number of comorbidities of interest. Terms of follow-up, we ended up having a median follow-up of about 4 months, with maximum follow-up extending out to 6.5 months for this study. So you're looking now at the cumulative incidence curves, and in the top left-hand plot, you see the negative outcome control for RSV infections in that first 13-day window after the index. And it shows nearly identical risk of documented infections in the matched groups, which was good. Then as you move left to right, top to bottom, you'll see the curves for infections, ED urgent care, and hospitalizations, with the teal being the unvaccinated group. And you can see a divergence in curves, with the unvaccinated being at higher risk. In terms of the VE, I'll draw your attention to the box on the right-hand side where you see the VE estimates, and those ranged from 78% for documented infection to 80% for RSV-associated hospitalization. And then I'll highlight a couple of key subgroups of interest. The first is age, and the second is whether or not individuals were immunocompromised. And you can see that there's essentially protection across all age subgroups, and also importantly, protection for immunocompromised individuals. So to conclude, in this patient population of veterans that were vaccinated during the fall of 23, these vaccine products were effective in preventing not only illness, but subsequent hospitalization, and other healthcare encounters during a median follow-up of more than 4 months. And those estimates range from 78% to 80%, as I mentioned. And we did observe protection across all age groups and immunocompromised persons. This was a very large study, larger than either clinical trial, and we included a good representation from those key subgroups of interest: elderly folks, cardiopulmonary disease, immunocompromised folks, and observed protection in these groups, which I think was important for policy. We also observed protection against RSV-associated hospitalization. In terms of limitations, we did go to lengths to try and capture vaccinations and the related outcomes, but it is possible that if veterans sought care outside of the system, we wouldn't have captured those. As with all observational studies, there is possibility for residual confounding, although that negative outcome control was reassuring. I will say that this study was not designed to estimate protection against milder illness. That is a harder thing to study. And while we didn't confirm hospitalization or ED and urgent care encounters to be specifically associated with RSV infection, defining a very tight window, I think, effectively achieved that. When we did some chart review QC, we were seeing a lot of these folks have respiratory illness consistent with RSV. I'd like to highlight that our group collaborated with the ACIP adult work group in this process and actually contributed our data that was presented at the public ACI meeting in June of this past year. And for the clinicians on the call, you'll recall that initially the recommendation was for a shared clinical decision making, which had its challenges. And so after this meeting, the policy vote was updated to recommend universally a single RSV vaccine dose for all adults that were 75 and older, as well as those in the 60 to 74 year age range who were at increased risk for severe disease based on a number of comorbidities. So with that, I will hand it back over to George.
Oh, thanks, Christina. So we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness. And in this part of the presentation, I'm going to describe the results of four target trial emulations that we did to probe into COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness as the vaccines evolved during the pandemic and at different phases of the pandemic. I'm not going to describe in detail methods just in the interest of time, but this vaccine effectiveness studies that I will be describing used analogous methods to the ones that Christina described in detail for RSV vaccine effectiveness. So first, just a reminder, it seems like an eternity since the pandemic began, to just illustrate the evolution of different COVID-19 vaccines in the last 4 years. So by December 2020, not even a year into the pandemic, we had vaccines, including even a completely new platform of mRNA vaccines, which were targeting the so-called ancestral or Wuhan strain. And those were employed from December 2020 onwards as primary vaccination. And then in September of 2021, the CDC made a recommendation for booster vaccination, which essentially meant it another vaccine targeting the same strain. The booster vaccines were a slightly lower dose for the Moderna, the same dose for Pfizer, and people got one or more than one booster vaccines from September 2021 to the beginning of the next respiratory season, more or less in August. So you'll see the changes keep happening at the beginning of each respiratory season around September or August. So August 2022, the bivalent vaccine was introduced, which was targeting both the original Wuhan strain as well as by then two Omicron subvariants, BA.4 and BA.5, around December and January of December 2021, January 2022. Omicron took over and became the predominant virus and has remained the predominant virus since then. Then in September of 2023, another vaccine was introduced. I think it was called the updated vaccine. Probably a misnomer. It was basically a new vaccine. Better to have called it a new vaccine. It was a completely new vaccine that was targeting a different subvariant, the XBB.1.5, which was the subvariant that was predominating in the couple of months just before the vaccine was introduced in September, in the hopes that it would have better coverage. So that was the vaccine that was used in the last season from 23 to 24. And then just a few months ago, then another updated vaccine or new vaccine was introduced, which is the one we're using now, which is targeting the KP.2 subvariant of Omicron, which was the variant that was predominating in the couple of months before August 2024. So we looked at in a number of target trial emulations. We looked at primary vaccinations, vaccine effectiveness, the booster vaccinations. We compared Pfizer and Moderna vaccinations, and we looked at the XBB.1.5 vaccine effectiveness, and these are the results that are going to present to you in order, because there are some interesting patterns that I think are evolving, and it's nice to see these results, side by side. So primary vaccination, I know this sounds like an eternity ago, but this was the results of our study that we evaluated using target trial emulation, like Christina described, sequential trials, and using exact matching followed by propensity score matching to match unvaccinated participants to vaccinated participants during the first year after the introduction of the primary vaccination. And the figures show the cumulative incidence of infection and death, which corresponded during this time period to a vaccine effectiveness against COVID-19 infection of 69%. And against death of 86%. And I remember at the time being disappointed that I thought that was low, because the randomized control trials were showing vaccine effectiveness in the high 90s. I had to think hard about did we do was there some bias in our studies? I think in hindsight, as you'll see, this is much more realistic of what to expect for a variety of reasons when these vaccines are deployed in the real world. So that was what we found looking at primary vaccination. And then we turned our attention to comparing the two most commonly used vaccines, certainly at the VA, but even in the US as a whole at the time, which was the two mRNA vaccines, the Moderna versus the Pfizer vaccine, primary vaccination, to study if there was any difference in the effectiveness between the two vaccines. And that was plausible because the Moderna primary vaccination had more than three times the dose. It was 100 microgram vaccine dose versus 30 for the Pfizer dose. The dosing was slightly different. The two doses were 4 weeks apart for Moderna, 3 weeks apart for Pfizer, and the nanoparticle, the lipid nanoparticle that delivers the mRNA was slightly different. And indeed, there are actually some pretty significant differences in effectiveness with the Moderna primary vaccination at the time, resulting in lower rates of infection, hospitalization, and the deaths were also lower, but that wasn't statistically significant. And other studies at the time also showed a similar effect. And as time went by since vaccination, so the one advantage you have by doing target trial emulations using real-world data is that you can have studies that extend for 6, 7, 8 months since vaccination. You can see this expanding difference between the two vaccines, which was related partly to the fact that as more time went by, there was more waning perhaps of effectiveness in one versus the other. But the real impetus that caused this divergence in the two figures was the emergence of the Delta variant at the time, corresponding to that part of the curve that you're looking at there. So that was Moderna versus Pfizer. And then by 2021 and onwards, the recommendation for booster vaccination was made by the CDC, and we wanted to investigate the extent to which booster versus no booster was effective, and the effectiveness essentially of a booster vaccine versus receiving no booster vaccine among patients who had already received primary vaccination. So the same kind of analysis. This is a target trial emulation with sequential trials, bi-weekly time intervals. We match a non-booster recipient to a person who received the booster vaccine in each trial, using exact matching for followed by propensity score matching. And you can see the results that we found here in both the cumulative incidence curves and the actual vaccine effectiveness that result from those were lower than in this case of primary vaccination. So in this case, for booster vaccination, the vaccine effectiveness was 42% against infection, 53% against hospitalization, 79% against death. We skipped the bivalent vaccine. We did not study bivalent vaccine effectiveness. It was kind of like a blur between finishing the prior trials, and the XBB.1.5 vaccine was already introduced around August of 2023. And we just finished this study, which is now accepted for publication. And I'm just going to show you the results of this project. So in this project, we did a target trial emulation of receiving the XBB.1.5 vaccine versus not among VA enrollees who had received vaccinations before that, with an enrollment period between October 2023 and January 2024, and then subsequent follow-up for outcomes extending all the way to May 2024. The mean follow-up in this trial was 176 days. And we investigated the usual outcomes, which was SARS-CoV-2 infection or hospitalization or death after infection. And these are the results for the entire study. So when you follow people all the way until May with an average follow-up of almost 6 months, there was no benefit of the XBB.1.5 vaccine against infection. So the vaccine effectiveness was minus 3.3%. And a pretty modest benefit against hospitalization of only 16.7%, and benefit against death of 26.6%. These are the cumulative incidence curves showing the cumulative incidence of infection in the top left. The results, the two curves are in the vaccinated and unvaccinated, or I should say XBB.1.5 recipients versus no XBB.1.5, are almost superimposed. Hospitalization curves are slightly separate, with the vaccine recipients having slightly lower rates of hospitalization that corresponded to that vaccine effectiveness of about 16 or 17%. And the death rates are also slightly different, which resulted in that vaccine effectiveness against death of 26%. And that's the negative outcome control in the bottom right, which shows infection rates in the first 10 days after the vaccine, or the matched index date in the unvaccinated persons, showing that the curves are superimposed, suggesting we don't have a big problem with unmeasured confounding or outcome ascertainment. Now, as I said, this target trial had a very long follow-up period. So all the way until May, mean follow-up was 6 months, 180 days, and maximum follow-up was even longer than that, 7 or 8 months, which allowed us to study the vaccine effectiveness at different time points to see how much waning of vaccine effectiveness is going on as time accrues since vaccination. So, and there's substantial waning is what these figures are demonstrating. So when we looked at vaccine effectiveness against infection extending only to 60 days, vaccine effectiveness was 14%, and then 7% by 90 days, 3.1% by 120 days, and no vaccine effectiveness at the end of the study, with a mean follow-up of 180 days. Similarly, for hospitalization, vaccine effectiveness waned from 37.6% when we looked at it at 60 days of follow-up, all the way down to 16.6% by the end of the study's follow-up, which was 180 days of mean follow-up. And vaccine effectiveness against death, again, very substantial waning. When we looked at 60 days, vaccine effectiveness at 60 days against death was 54%, but decreased all the way down to 26.6% at the end of the study, with a mean follow-up of 6 months. So, what were the take-home messages for me from this analysis, and what do we plan to do next? Well, obviously, there is already a new vaccine which the VA and others are using, and the VA deployed or used at least 700,000 vaccines for the KP.2 vaccine since August, and we have an ongoing analysis of that vaccine effectiveness. And that would be very exciting, at least for me, to see where that lands. I think these results to me are a source for some thinking about what are the reasons for this low COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness, especially as we proceed during the pandemic and with each successive vaccine. That may be related to high levels of baseline natural and vaccine-related immunity in the population, making it that the incremental effect of each vaccine becomes less and less. Immune imprinting, or the so-called original antigenic sin, is an important consideration whereby when a new vaccine is developed, the immune system tends to respond more strongly to the epitopes it's already known, it's already seen from prior vaccines or prior infections, instead of the new epitopes that are displayed from the new subvariants that the new vaccine is targeting. And of course, the COVID has shown us time and time again is evolving so rapidly that by the time a vaccine is selected and designed in August, the beginning of each season, based on what vaccine was circulating, or sorry, based on what variant was circulating in May or June, and the vaccine comes in August, and is and the virus has already evolved to new subvariants, which may or may not have significant differences in their spike proteins and other critical components that make the vaccines potentially less effective. So I know, although I know that the results are kind of disappointing about the vaccine effectiveness or the XBB.1.5, I think the way I look at it is like a call to action that maybe we shouldn't just accept low vaccine effectiveness rates that decline over time, and that this should be a call to really get back to the drawing board and perhaps design future COVID-19 vaccine strategies that are potentially more effective and result in less waning and don't have to be redesigned year after year. I'm going to hand it back to Christina now to discuss severity of COVID-19 influenza and RSV infections.
Sorry to
Christina?
interrupt, but I'm getting some questions about the slides not being seen. So I just give me a minute, okay, you guys? And I'm going to stop sharing this content and reshare it, actually. So one moment, please. Thank you. I appreciate it, and I'm sorry for the disruption. Okay. That should have just gone away. I'm opening and sharing the slides again. It's going to take me a few seconds to navigate to them. I'm also disconnected from VPN. When it rains, it pours. One moment, please, everybody.
We can share our slides too, Rob, if it's easier. Whatever you want.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and try to share the slide from your computer? Does that make sense?
I have it. Do you want to share, Christina? I have my presentation open. What do you want to do?
Yeah, why don't I, let me, I've got something open. Why don't I go ahead and share? Give me a second.
Christina, I just made you the presenter if you're going to share from your screen. And if you just put that in slideshow mode, that should fill our screen.
Heidi, who's presenting right now?
Christina.
Okay.
All right. Does that work?
Thank you.
Perfect.
Folks able to
Thank
see
you.
okay? Good. Okay. So to transition to talking about severity of some of these different respiratory viruses, why were we interested in this? Well, you know, one, these still cause quite a significant morbidity and mortality, particularly in our older patient population and in folks with chronic medical conditions. We have vaccines for all three, but vaccine uptake remains low. And COVID is constantly evolving, as George alluded to. We have new variants, we have reinfections, folks have gotten vaccinated, things have changed very much since, you know, even 2 years ago. And understanding the relative severity can help to guide targeted vaccination efforts and inform public health policy. There are also some gaps in the literature, and these include a need for a contemporary comparison among outpatients, and a need for information on long-term adverse outcomes, including death. Some of the previous studies were also criticized for not utilizing concurrent same-day testing of all three viruses to reduce selection bias. And so these are all things we sought to address in updating this comparison. So for this study, I will say that we still thought carefully about a target trial framework, though technically you were not conducting a study in which you were inoculating folks to infection and, you know, clinical disease. But we still relied on some of those design principles. We included non-hospitalized veterans who underwent same-day testing for all three viruses over two respiratory illness seasons, first in 22-23, then 23-24, but who only tested positive for one virus on that day. So we really were trying to capture the first infection in a given season. We then used inverse probability weighting instead of matching this time to achieve baseline balance of characteristics, but we did use many of those demographic, geographic, clinical characteristics that I showed you earlier. And I will say that in contrast to the RSV VE study, we were able to integrate hospitalization and vaccination data from CMS Medicare. For our outcomes, we looked at 30-day hospitalization, ICU admissions, and deaths, as well as death extending through 180 days. What I want to highlight here across the two seasons are the relative numbers of SARS-CoV-2 infections as compared with flu or RSV. SARS-CoV-2, by far and away, is much more common than the other two viruses amongst the cohort with same-day testing. And also, most eligible veterans, about 70%, were diagnosed in the emergency department for all viruses. The other thing to have as important context is that adverse outcomes were common. Hospitalization, 14 to 18% of folks were getting hospitalized, ICU stays 2 to 4%, and deaths were also not by any means trivial, even, you know, in the current era. So what you are seeing here are on the top, the 22-23 season, and then the bottom 23-24. And then as you go left to right, you're looking at the different pairwise comparisons. And so I'll draw your attention first to the comparisons that include RSV, which really shows that it is potentially a milder illness, or put in another way, you know, it is associated with lower risk of severe outcomes across the board, whether that's hospitalizations, deaths, et cetera. Now, if you focus on comparisons that include COVID versus flu in the middle, and then COVID versus RSV on the right, you can see that COVID is associated with more adverse outcomes, whether it be hospitalization, ICU stays, and then interestingly, deaths. And I'm going to draw your attention to that here, where you can see that there is an increased risk in death at 30 days, and that continues to progress at 90 days and 180 days. Now, not shown here, but something we did look at is, well, what happens beyond 180 days? That increase does tend to plateau between 180 and 360 days, or at a year, and then hold steady thereafter. So it's not like an indefinite increase in perpetuity. So, the other thing that's was interesting is that differences were most pronounced among the older patient groups, and they were also more apparent among persons who were unvaccinated for their respective infections. And for this, we limited a comparison to SARS-CoV-2 and influenza, largely because of the limitation of numbers. So did they get an updated vaccine product that season, or did they get their seasonal flu shot or not? So to conclude, SARS-CoV-2 remains not only more common than flu or RSV, but it is still associated with more severe disease outcomes, including short-term hospitalization and mortality extending through 6 months. And I think our findings provide indirect support for vaccination remaining an important strategy for minimizing the impact of these respiratory viral illnesses, particularly COVID. I will continue to share my screen, but turn it over to George to discuss some future directions.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you're not sharing anymore, Christina. It's back to your
you. Rob, here, let me share again. Oh.
Maybe I can share. Do you have?
I've got it. Okay, that should be. We should be back.
Okay, good. Yes. So we've described a lot of work that the CSP 2038 is doing. This is our CSP funded study. And in addition to the vaccine effectiveness for COVID-19 and RSV and the severity of illness, we did a lot of work that we didn't have time to present today on pharmacotherapy effectiveness for example, for Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, and we're doing work now on oseltamivir or Tamiflu. And in this process, also we've established some really important partnerships and collaborations within and outside the VA. We've got some really great federal partners that we work really closely with and have regular meetings, including partners from the FDA, from BARDA, which is the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, another agency within the Department of Health and Human Services, with the CDC, including the CDC's Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, ACIP, that makes recommendations for vaccinations and actually considered a lot of our data even before it was published. So it's great to see VA data being used by the FDA and CDC in decision-making. We're very grateful to a lot of VA partners, and it's been really humbling to see how willing people across operations and research are to help with our research endeavors within the VA, specifically Pharmacy Benefits Management, PBM, the Public Health National Program Office, the National Center for Prevention, of course, Virex, Cypher, and the whole Vinci enterprise, and many VA investigators and clinicians. And within the academic and research community. And we would like to think of this project, the CSP 2038, which goes by the acronym COPE-VA, to become a resource for selected work on pharmacotherapy effectiveness using cutting-edge target trial emulation design and causal inference, and using the VA's electronic health records, which are, I think, a national treasure, using that to answer questions of pharmacotherapy and vaccine effectiveness more broadly going forward. And you want to switch to the next slide, Christina? The CSP 2038, which goes by the acronym COVA, which stands for COVID Pharmacotherapy Effectiveness in the VA, as we've evolved, we've kind of rebranded or rebaptized the study into Clinical Outcomes and Pharmacotherapy Effectiveness, still COPE-VA, to emphasize that we're broadening the scope of work of this collaboration to study not just COVID-19 drugs and vaccines, but other respiratory illnesses, RSV, influenza, and COVID, and potentially other drugs of great interest to the VA and to the United States as a whole. I wanted to end by saying how grateful we are to the entire COPE-VA team, and specifically the CERC. CERC is the Clinical Epidemiology Research Center in West Haven, led by Michaela Slan as the director. It is basically the coordinating center that was assigned by the CSP program to execute this study. And that's where almost all the work is happening. And we're extremely grateful to Michaela and all the people listed under that in the CERC and in our own institutions in Portland and in Seattle for executing this project. Very grateful to Dr. Grant Huang as the CSP director and deputy creator for his support. And then for this group of federal collaborators, which has been a new experience for me, but it's been really amazing to work with people at the FDA, BARDA, and CDC, and have our results play a direct role in decision-making at those levels. And then within the VA, special thanks to Frank Cunningham at PBM and the folks at the Public Health National Program Office, Cynthia Lucero Buscan and Patricia Shermer, who helped us a lot with influenza and other infections that they've been monitoring for many, many years. We have some time for questions. I think this is the last of our slides, right, Christina? And a lot of questions were being posted as we were talking. And we can take some of them right now. Rob, is that how it works, the setting for these webinars?
Yes. And oftentimes the way it works is I read them aloud to you and you reply verbally. You want to go ahead and do it like that?
I've seen one. Let me just start with one while maybe Christina gets a chance to look at them. I see one on COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness that's really interesting. Eric Mooring is asking, is it fair to say that the overall cumulative effectiveness would depend on when in calendar time the major waves of COVID occur relative to when the most vaccination occurs? E.g., if most vaccinations occur in September and then there is a wave of infection in October and November, the overall vaccine effectiveness will be higher than if, say, the wave mostly occurred in January and February. And I think, Eric, you're absolutely right. If you vaccinate most people in September, August, September, October, and the biggest wave happens right after that, and assuming there is waning in vaccine effectiveness, that's the underlying assumption there, then most of the infections are going to happen at a time when the vaccine effectiveness is still high because it's early after the vaccination, and you're going to observe overall a higher vaccine effectiveness. But if there is truly another waning of vaccine effectiveness and a lot of the infections happen not at the time when most of the vaccines have been administered, but 3 or 4 or 5 months later, then what you're going to observe as vaccine effectiveness will be much lower. And I think this is really important because COVID-19 does not obey the same rules of seasonality as I think we've known for so many years for influenza and maybe even RSV, where you can kind of predict where most of the infections are going to happen. COVID-19 does have some seasonality, but not so great. So if there is waning of vaccine effectiveness and if the vaccine and if the infections are not as seasonal, then the timing of vaccination becomes critical, which I think is what you're alluding to. So sorry about the long answer, but it is a very interesting question and has a lot of implications. Christina, I don't know if you've seen some of the questions that you want to address.
Yeah, I'm going to just scroll down top to bottom. There's a comment about all respiratory, and basically with regard to all studies, that the propensity to test really complicates the estimates for severity in VE studies and also kind of presentation for illness, so that any outcome conditional on testing is a bias that is difficult to adjust for, but that death might kind of be a little bit immune to that. So yes, that's a very good point. And always a challenge. I will say, and reviewers have had us look carefully at this, like, well, how much testing is happening in the VA? Because if you're not testing enough, then that's a real issue. And the nice thing is with the quad testing, right, that's the concurrent COVID, flu A, flu B, and RSV, there is quite a lot of testing happening, certainly at least in the emergency department and urgent care setting. And so that helps deal with that issue to some degree. But yes, healthcare seeking behavior is always going to be a potential residual confounding. Now, we do think about preceding healthcare behaviors before that index date. So how many times you were hospitalized or sought outpatient care, and do match carefully on that to try and get at that somewhat. But yes, it's always going to be challenging.
Christina, there's a question on propensity to test, which I started trying to address in writing, but I didn't get to. And maybe you want to emphasize that, especially that the severity study that you described was limited to people who were tested for all infections at the same day, but only tested positive for one, right? Do you want to expand on that?
Yes.
A comment by Kevin McGonaghy. Do you see that?
Yes, and I think that was the comment that I just addressed. Yeah. But for the severity study, yes, specifically, we did not just take people who tested only, for COVID on one day and flu the next day. And so that was one of the major criticisms of previous studies, right? Well, I think you have COVID, so I'm going to test you for COVID. And that presents in a different way than, oh, maybe I think RSV is milder, so I'm only going to, you know. So we did specifically limit our eligible population to same day testing for all three viruses, but only tested positive for one. And then I think that would address your question, Eric, again, about same day being the, it doesn't necessarily have to be that platform. If for whatever reason you grabbed a, you know, COVID test in the ED and then you went back and tested for everything, we would consider that. But often it was the platform.
Steve is asking, I'll take one question from Steve S., which is a very nice point about, did your research team consider or look into any adverse effects of those vaccines or any correlated changes in all-cause mortality? And I like your question, Stephen. I'm going to digress a little bit also to say that, especially for COVID, as we try to study vaccine effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines, because more and more people get tested at home, it's going to become increasingly difficult to study vaccine effectiveness based on laboratory confirmed positive tests and their subsequent outcomes. And one way around that, which would also address your question, is instead to look at outcomes irrespective of, not anchored around a documented positive test. So you can see vaccinated and matched unvaccinated persons and follow them over time for all-cause mortality, like you're saying, or for that matter, for other hospitalizations. Now, there, of course, the analysis is less biased, but obviously no one is saying that vaccines will protect against non-COVID-related deaths. So your impact of the vaccine is potentially drowned by noise related to outcomes that cannot possibly be affected by the vaccine. But I think that's a very interesting analysis. In many ways, it's an easier analysis to do. And I think next time we do vaccine effectiveness analysis, we ought to present side by side also all-cause mortality and other outcomes unrelated to infection, not anchored around an infection, a confirmed infection episode. And that in parallel allows you also to address potential negative effects of vaccinations that people suspect may be there if you do such an analysis, adverse events related to vaccination and so on.
There is also a question or a comment about the issue of home testing and how that affects our ability to do research. Yes, that's does make it challenging. For me, I think one of the biggest things that affects is the generalizability, right? Presumably those might be milder illnesses if you test at home and then can convalesce at home and don't need to go to the ED or reach out to your doctor. And so, for example, for this relative severity study, that should be interpreted in the context of primarily people who are sick enough to show up in the ED or urgent care, right? That isn't doesn't translate to who has the sniffles at home and has less severe illness and what their 30-day and beyond outcomes are. So that I think has been one of the main limitations with the abundance of home testing, which is a wonderful thing. It's good for patients and just makes research challenging. So if any other questions we've missed, I'm scrolling through and I think we've addressed most of them.
It's a little complicated with all the messages about the slides not being broadcast.
If you still have a question and we've inadvertently skipped over it, feel free to put it on the top of the list and paste it in again.
Well, while we're waiting to see if anybody, if we, if you you skipped over any questions or if there are more, now's a good time for closing comments. Do either of you have closing comments you'd like to make?
Christina, do you want to go ahead?
I'll just say that it's, you know, it's been a wonderful privilege to be part of this platform and to, you know, as George shared, work with some of our federal partners and also partners across the VA. You know, I think we have a really wonderful clinical and research community, and that's unique to be able to kind of straddle both of those realms. And I think that's really enhanced the quality of our work. So if you're out there and you're listening to this presentation and you're someone we haven't crossed paths with and you have an interesting idea or want to collaborate in some way, please don't hesitate to reach out. Our emails are at the end of the presentation.
They're on the screen right now.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, same. In closing, I would say we're interested to hear from folks who have suggestions, comments later on as well. To the extent that we can, we would like to make ourselves available as a resource for expertise, if we can, related to target trial emulations using national VA data. We're happy to share our code, our methods, even our data, if you have the stomach to apply for all that, you get the approvals and so on. I honestly think the VA electronic health records are a national treasure, and we can do a lot using those electronic health records to help veterans and the FDA and the CDC with determining pharmacotherapy effectiveness. A lot more than what we're already doing. There's no other national healthcare system in the United States really with the scope of the VA, so, and that has a comprehensive healthcare system and electronic health records that the VA has. And so we have an amazing opportunity to contribute.
Great, thank you. Nothing else has come in. Attendees, if you have further questions or comments, both of our presenters' emails are being broadcast right now, their VA email addresses. Once again, I apologize for the technical problems, but I thank you both, Christina and George, for your live flexibility in becoming instant WebEx experts. When I close the webinar momentarily, a short survey will pop up for everybody. Please do take a few moments and provide answers to those questions. We review them and send them to the presenters. If there's something else that needs to be presented or follow up, that's a good way to get that information to our presenters. And we always review them and try to use them to continue to bring you high quality cyber seminars, such as this very popular one. Once again, I'll try Drs. Baima and Iaunu. I know I butchered that one. Thanks again for preparing and presenting and for your work generally in VA. And with that, I'll just go ahead and close the webinar. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays. Have a great day, everyone. Okay.